Good morning, church. Man, I tell you what, we've started spring break, in case you haven't noticed. All the families who are normally here are missing this morning. We certainly wish them safe travels, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of folks from Florida and other places who come here for spring break because they don't get, you know, this experience there. But yeah, we've got a lot of folks who are gone right now, but we are thankful for your presence, whether you're here with us in person or you're joining us online. I am thankful for all the recent baptisms, and a lot of godly parents have been putting in a lot of time, and teachers and Bible class teachers as well. You all, whether you are a Bible class teacher or a parent, your presence makes a difference. I just want you to know that. Like, them seeing faithful witness week after week after week, that matters. When they see other adults for whom the gospel and the kingdom matters, it begins to take root in their heart. So I thank you so much. It is a great time to be a part of the Forest Mill family. And it seems like things are changing rapidly, not just in our congregation, but in our community and in our area. We've got a lot of folks who are moving here from all over, and maybe you've noticed it as well, that there's a lot of folks that are moving here from California. My parents, up and down their street, they've got several neighbors. I think all of their neighbors have moved here from California. We've got a couple of families who have moved here from California, for which I'm really thankful. But it's hard for folks who have been here a long time to make that adjustment. And I heard recently about one older blind gentleman. He went to visit one of the local establishments, and it had been a while, in fairness, since he'd been in there, and a lot had changed. He just didn't know that. So he found himself a seat at the bar, and he ordered himself a drink, and when the bartender brought it over, the old guy decided to break the ice with a joke, and he said, "Hey, you want to hear a joke about people from California?" And all of a sudden, the whole place got real quiet. And the bartender leaned over to the old man, and in a low voice, he said, "Mister, you're old and you're blind, so I'm going to give you a chance here. But what you don't know is I'm 6'2", 275 pounds, and I just moved here from California to buy this fine establishment. On your left is my bouncer. He's 6'5", 315, former defensive tackle for UCLA, and he's from California, too. On your right is the former state arm wrestling champion from the state of California. He's got arms that are bigger than both your scrawny legs put together. So you want to tell that joke, mister?" Old man lowered his head and slowly shook it. "No," he said, "not if I'm going to have to explain it four times." I gave our California folks a heads up because I don't think that's them. I don't mean to insult our brothers and sisters from California, some of whom are here this morning. They're just as intelligent and capable as any of us, and we love y'all, and we're thankful for your presence this morning. But someone had to be the butt of the joke, and right now, in this area, they make easy targets. And honestly, it's usually pretty simple for us to single out other folks who are different from us and poke fun of them, whether it's historically, it's been people of other races, or people of the opposite sex, or people from different parts of the country, or people who are from other parts of your own immediate area. Someone who won't get the joke. I mean, that's the whole object, right? But the truth is, there's always folks just like us who don't get it. Folks who hear and see the same things we hear and see, but they don't understand it the same way. Now, no doubt, there were people to whom Mark wrote his gospel who were grappling with a similar question. They were looking around trying to figure out why, except for their small circle, why is the whole rest of the world seemingly unchanged by the gospel? I mean, if Jesus coming here is the inbreaking of the kingdom of God, why isn't the whole world changed, right? Why isn't everybody else getting it? So in response, Mark has been sort of opening up to us about Jesus, revealing Jesus' identity to us. And he puts together here in the fourth chapter, last week we went through the parable of the sower, the parable of the seeds, in which he scatters seed on these four different soils. And some soils get it, some soils don't. And on the heels of that, Mark gives us like some wisdom teaching from Jesus and a couple of really short little parables that reveal the nature of the kingdom of God. So in Mark chapter 4, beginning at verse 21, he says this, do you bring in a lamp and put it under a bowl or a bed? No, I'm going to let it shine, right, Tommy? Instead, don't you put it on its stand? For whatever is hidden is meant to be disclosed, and whatever is concealed is meant to be brought out into the open. And maybe now we begin to see why so many people didn't get Jesus' parables. He tells us right here, it's hidden, it's secret, it's concealed, right? And we try to make sense out of sayings like this with songs like This Little Light of Mine, but I don't think that's the point Jesus is making here. At least he's not taking Jesus' story to mean that. He seems to be saying that the nature of the kingdom of God was that it was hidden. The whole kingdom was hidden. It's been there, and Jesus' coming was meant to reveal it. He's like, this is a big deal, and it's been kind of under your nose the whole time, and Jesus' coming is what takes that lamp out from under the bed or under a bushel, and Jesus' coming puts it on the lampstand so that it might be revealed. The evidence for the kingdom of God is there for anyone who seeks it. I remember years ago, and maybe you remember this era, they don't do it as much anymore, at least not that I noticed, when someone big and famous would enter, whether it's like a rock star or a wrestler or a big-time athlete, and when they would make their entrance, it was a big deal, right? The dramatic music would start first, and then the lights would start flashing or the lights would dim, and everyone knew, everyone who was in the know at least, knew something big was about to happen. And for all of you who had paid attention, there were these clues. There was the swirling lights, there was the beat of the drum, the fog on the stage, so to speak. And then all of a sudden, this person would appear. They would pop out of a hole in the stage or come sliding down a zip line, or they'd come bursting through the gate in the bullpen, and it would be like a big deal. Their entrance would be a big deal. Well, Jesus is coming. His life, his death, his burial, his resurrection, his ascension, they all point us towards something bigger that's still coming. We think about Jesus coming as a big deal, and I'm not trying to downplay Jesus coming at all. It was a huge deal. It was the inbreaking of the kingdom of God, but it was the beginning. A great deal of the kingdom was unveiled when Jesus came, but he kept pointing forward, saying there's more to come, there's more to come, there's so much more to come. You're going to do things greater than I've done. You're going to see things greater than you've seen already. And we have to look, we have to listen, we have to pay attention, sometimes really carefully, in order to pick up on the clues that God has intentionally sort of spread around in order for us to pick up on what's happening. This is how people, as Mark is explaining here, this is how people respond to the message about the kingdom of God. But let me tell you something about the nature of that kingdom. And he tells us two short parables. And he also said, this is what the kingdom of God is like. You want to know what the kingdom is like? Here's what the kingdom is like. A man scatters seed on the ground, right? This starts off like the last parable we heard, but this is a little different. Man scatters seed on the ground night and day, whether he sleeps or gets up, the seed sprouts and grows, though he doesn't even know how. And all by itself, the soil produces grain. First the stalk, and then the head, then the full kernel in the head. And as soon as the grain is ripe, he puts the sickle to it because the harvest has come. Have y'all ever read that parable before? Anybody ever wondered what that meant? I didn't know. I always thought it was a strange little follow-up to the parable of the sower, the parable of the seeds that I've heard lots of lessons about. But I think what he's saying is it's easy to get discouraged when we look around at Christianity in our world. We look around and we're like, man, this next generation, or maybe the previous generation, or maybe we're just looking at ourselves and we know how messed up we are. It's hard when we see those flaws in others or in ourselves, and when we hear it on the news. You know, it's a regular occurrence on the news when some Christian preacher or teacher or pastor or politician or youth pastor or somebody has done something completely terrible. And it's always like painted as incongruent with their faith. You know, this guy was a deacon at the local church, or this lady taught Bible class at her church, and look what she did to her own kids. You know, you hear those stories and you're like, oh, why? These people, they're killing me, right? They're making Christianity look so bad. But I think what this parable teaches us, and a lesson that'd be really good for us to know, is that the kingdom of God grows by God's power, not ours. The kingdom of God is not because I am good, or I'm capable, or I'm smart, or I always make good decisions. This kingdom grows, whether I know it or not, whether I know how it works or not, just like that man who scatters seed, and the seed grows. The farmer does not make the seed grow, right? You can do everything right. You can plant at the right time. You can have the soil prepared just right. You can do everything right, and it grows or it doesn't grow. You don't get any control over that. That's what he's saying, is that the kingdom is going to grow not by our power, but by the power of God. The kingdom is going to come in God's time, in God's way, not by human effort or in accordance with human logic. So God is the one who makes the kingdom grow. And if that God is the one who makes the kingdom grow, we can rest confident and assured even when it doesn't make sense to us. Even when there's a revival in a prison where, you know, the worst of the worst are kept. Even when it's the people that we least expect to get and hear and receive and respond to the kingdom of God, it happens like that. It happens in far corners of the world where the gospel shouldn't be. It happens in big ways and in small ways. It happens in homes we consider too broken to be receptive soil for the gospel. It does not happen by our power. And as much as we'd like to think so, we're not the ones in charge of history. We don't write the history of the world. We try to interpret it, but we don't write it. God is in full control of history, and it's all going to accomplish and unfurl according to his plans, not ours. And then he tells a second parable. He says, again, he said, what shall we say the kingdom of God is like? Or what parable shall we use to describe it? It's like a mustard seed, which is the smallest of all seeds on earth. He's using hyperbole here. We know there's smaller seeds. Don't get caught up in that. He's just saying, you know, it's the tiniest seed we got around here. Yet when planted, it grows and becomes the largest of all the shrubs, with such big branches that even the birds can perch in its shade. I want you to think about the ministry of Jesus. Like Jesus, full-time ministry, 3 years, going around being the Son of God. And when he died, he had somewhere around 100 followers. 12 of whom were really close, we think of, but around 100 followers. 3 years of the Son of God preaching day in and day out in one tiny corner of the ancient world. 3 years of hardship and persecution for the Christ. 3 years of miracles and wonders. 100 people. 3 years preaching to thousands, 3 years feeding thousands, calming storms, healing the sick, raising the dead. I mean, all this stuff that, you know, I'd be pretty impressed if you did any one of those things. He does it for 3 years and he has 100 followers. But the kingdom of God is like a mustard seed, he says. And which is a strange choice of analogies. The mustard seed was synonymous with something tiny. You want to talk about something tiny in their day, you compared it to a mustard seed. And it is small. Again, not the smallest seed in the world, but it was the smallest probably in their world that they knew about. And the bush does grow pretty large. I mean, it's not the biggest bush in the world, but it's a big bush. But here's the crazy thing. The thing that makes this a weird analogy for us is that the mustard bush, the mustard tree, grows wild. It's not like, hey, I think I want to be a mustard farmer. Now, obviously the French's people perfected it. But in Jesus' day, when he's talking about it, he's like, no, you don't have mustard farmers running around. This is just a wild bush that grows out there. It's really useful, but it's impossible to control because you have all those tiny seeds and they blow everywhere. So you don't get nice, neat rows of mustard trees in an orchard, right? You just get mustard bushes kind of going everywhere. And it germinates really quickly. And before you know it, it will take over not just where you planted it in your garden. It can take over the rest of your garden where you're trying to grow vegetables. It'll take over your field where you're trying to graze your sheep. It'll take over everything, leaving you with nothing but a bunch of mustard bushes. So when Jesus proclaims that the kingdom of God took root like a mustard tree, everybody knew what he was talking about because that's exactly what the gospel did. The gospel, who when Jesus died, had 100 followers, it goes on to topple empires and power structures. It upset the course of kings and kingdoms. It set the rotation of the world in order. And we've seen how that can happen with individual people, individuals whose lives are just sort of upset by the gospel, and they're going in one direction, and they get hit by Jesus, and boom, it changes their life dramatically. But the same thing happens across the entire scope of human history. That moment in history when Jesus came and spread the good news, it was like somebody took a 2x4 to human history and changed everything. Everything from that point forward. It only made sense to change our calendars in accordance because it shaped and changed human history dramatically. It just sort of took over everything. To use a modern analogy, we might compare it to the kudzu. How many of you know kudzu? Isn't it lovely? Cows will eat it if you got cows, but that's about it. It makes pretty good cover for a duck blind. I'll say that. After that, there's not a lot of uses for it. And man, that stuff, you can't kill it. You can't stop it. You can only hope to contain it. It just keeps going on and on. It's like impossible to rein in. That's what he says the kingdom of God is like. It gets started and goes wild and produces way more than you would expect out of one tiny seed. So as the residents of this kingdom, it's on us to be on and be a part of that activity of God. We're just throwing ourselves. We're like, look, this doesn't look like much, but I believe God is in it, and it's going to take off. And it may be a small thing. It may be just a kind word spoken here, or an act of kindness, or an act of sacrifice, or an act of service. It could be changing jobs, or it could be, you know, who knows, all these little things. But we have to be on the lookout. Pay attention to the clues. Or to take the words of Jesus, we have to, he with ears, let him listen. If you got ears, just pay attention. We might think of it a little bit like a great treasure hunt. Back in 2010, there was this guy, he was 80 years old. His name was Forrest Fenn. And Forrest Fenn was an antiquities dealer. He'd become pretty wealthy in his day. By this point, he's 80 years old, 2010, he's 80 years old. And he's also a writer. And so he announces in 2010 that he has hidden about $2 million somewhere in the Rocky Mountains. The contents of the chest aren't exactly known, but there were 19th century coins, there were gold nuggets, there were rare jewels, there were ancient artifacts, and more in some small bronze chest. I mean, a little bronze chest worth about $2 million. The only hints that he gave were that it's located somewhere between 5,000 and 10,000 feet of elevation, that it's located near some trees, so that ought to narrow it down, that he hauled it there himself in two loads, two trips, and he also states that there are about 10 clues hidden in a poem in his self-published book. The book was called The Thrill of the Chase, and then he shares the poem. Now, the poem starts out like this. He says, "As I have gone alone in there and with my treasures bold, I can keep my secret where and hint of riches new and old." And it's just a silly little poem. It goes on for like six or seven more little short stanzas. It does not tell you exactly where it is. You've got to decipher it. I mean, you've got to read between lines and read between those lines and everything. And so it took a long time. I mean, the Rocky Mountains are pretty big. It's not just like each individual mountain is big, but the range is enormous. It goes way up into Canada. And so eventually, about 10 years later, Finn's treasure was found by this young medical student. His name's Jack Stoof. I think that's how you pronounce it. Jack Stoof, this guy right here. He said he deciphered the poem in 2018, about, you know, 8 years into the things, when he figured out the hints from the poem. But then after he figured out what the poem was saying, it took him two more years of hunting after that. And I love this quote for him. He tried to remain anonymous for a long time, but eventually gets brought out into the open. And this is what he said about it. He says, "This treasure hunt was the most frustrating experience of my life. There were a few times when I, exhausted, covered in scratches and bites and sweat and pine pitch, and nearing the end of my day's water supply, sat down on a downed tree and I just cried alone in the woods in sheer frustration." Can you imagine? He is wandering, out there, he is wandering some of the most rugged terrain on this continent. And he's doing this for 2 years. 2 years of heartache and exhaustion and frustration and nicks and bumps and bites and all that. And it took him all that time to find it. But in the end, he found it. Brothers and sisters, I'm here to tell you this morning that we're all looking for something. Maybe you know exactly what you're looking for. Some of us just kind of wander around thinking we'll find it, what it is. Some of us are looking for wealth. Some are looking for power or success. Or we're looking for love in all the wrong places. But we're looking for something. And Jesus is telling us that we are wasting our time looking for all these wrong things when the kingdom of God is just waiting for you to uncover it. Jesus came and he revealed its presence. Like, he showed that the kingdom of God is here. He showed you what it looked like. Like, look at the life of Jesus. See how transformative the life of Jesus was. He gave you all the keys so that you can unlock this box. He gave you all the encouragement to go and do it. He grabbed your shoulders and points you in the right direction. It's like, go get that, because that is life. So my prayer for you, my prayer for us as a church this week, is that we may be kingdom-seeking people. That wherever we are, whatever we're doing, we may be at work or at home or in the community or wherever it is we're going, on vacation or at home, whatever it is, wherever we're going, that we will be kingdom-seeking people. That we will be people not only looking for the work of God in ourselves, but we will grab somebody else by the shoulders and point to them and say, "Hey, you're spending a lot of time searching for happiness in all the wrong places. This is worth going after. And Jesus came so that you could have it and have it to the full." My prayer for us is that this week we will be revealing that life. And if this morning, if we can encourage you, lift you up for strength, for forgiveness, for new direction or redirection. We want to do that now. If we can help you, won't you come as we stand and as we sing?